Welcome to today's podcast. This is part of the Race Equity Month series that we're running through November. And I have joining me today Dr. Carlene Cornish and Dr. Cynthia Okpakiri, who are both from the University of East Anglia. What we're particularly exploring in this podcast is cost of living, and we're looking at how that is in relation to racial inequity. And we'll be exploring whether we do find cost of living being the crisis that exists currently, whether that's being experienced unequally by particular populations within the healthcare student demographic. My background is as a Dean of the School of Applied Sciences at Aberdeen University, and I'm also the Chair of the Council of Deans Equality, Diversity and Inclusion Strategic Policy Group. One of the areas that we've chosen to focus on particularly is cost of living, because anecdotally we're hearing about how that's impacting recruitment and retention within our student populations. And I'll come back to that at the end of this podcast and explain what we're taking forward in that regard. But I'm very keen to hear from both Carlene and Cynthia about the work that they're doing and what their thoughts are around about the cost of living crisis. So my first question then, and I'll ask this of Carlene first, but then I'm going to ask Cynthia for you to come in too. And the first question is in relation to, is that what you're hearing from both your colleagues and what you're experiencing in relation to students in your own institution, that cost of living is impacting students and particularly those from minoritised backgrounds? And so is your sense that they are being disproportionately affected? And if so, then what factors do you think are feeding into that? So Carlene, over to you.
Yes, Andrea, I absolutely agree. We find with the students at UEA, also known as the University of East Anglia, that ethnic minority students are significantly impacted by the cost of living crisis. I say that because, I mean, when we look historically, and just a couple of years back, you know, when we had the pandemic, for example, there has been loads of research that have come out that confirms that ethnic minority communities has been significantly impacted by higher mortality rates. And with the higher mortality rates, it's often students then deeply impacted by a sense of loss, grief, and also increased family responsibilities and caring responsibilities. So we have that component we have to consider. There are higher unemployment rates because of the pandemic. And so what that therefore means is the extreme pressure to provide for the family. In that sense, there are higher levels of poverty. And yeah, we talk about food insecurity, fuel poverty, those kind of issues, I know other communities are also experiencing, but even significantly more when you're from a minoritized background because of broader structural inequality. So when we try to answer this question, it's really important to bear in mind the context in which the students are living, the broader structure, socio-structural inequalities that's around them, and essentially acknowledge that these students, when they come to our universities, they embody these structural inequalities when they come into our university lectures. Some of the students face insecure housing issues. Parents are on zero tolerance contracts. And so there's enormous pressure they bring with them into the lecture venue. So it is sometimes really important in those kind of spaces to more or less remember that you have a student sitting in front of you carrying the hope of the family on their shoulders, because normally from ethnic minority communities, education carries significant value because somehow there's still the belief that education can open doors that has been historically locked for many people from our community. So investing in education is crucial. However, staying in education can become tricky and a lot harder when you're faced with the cost of living crisis that is currently impacting everyone, but still there's the legacy, the historical legacy that makes it an additional challenge for these young people from African, Asian, descent. It's impacting a larger proportion of our students. The other thing I also wanted to say in response to your question, Andrea, is also just to put it out there from the start, is that a lot of students from ethnic minority backgrounds, especially those from Africa and the Caribbean countries, it's really important to remember that the values that they hold, is connected to a sense of connectedness. So there's the sense of connectedness, there's interdependence, and there's this collective kind of responsibility we tend to carry towards our family. So you can see that sort of merit within the family structures, but also you see that in how we carry out our relationships with each other. So it's all collective and interconnected. And so it's not individualistic that you'd find within Eurocentric kind of communities as such. It's very collective. And so students from ethnic minoritized kind of backgrounds, therefore, they embody not just the social structural kind of issues we talk about, but they are carrying this collective kind of responsibility. And so with the cost of living crisis, they will never think, or, when I go and work, I'll feed myself and my family. They know they whatever they work for has to benefit family, for example, in Africa, has to benefit the neighbors who are like families. So yeah, disproportionate they this disproportionately impacted by the cost of living crisis, because it's not just them being impacted, but the wider community too.
Thank you very much for Carleen, and that's it really valuable for us to have that wider understanding about, as you say, it's not just the individual. There's a network there that equally well they feel responsibility for, and I know that there are challenges, obviously, again for healthcare students because of unsocial hours and how that might affect childcare, and likewise because of transport. But Cynthia, in terms of your own insights as well, as to how it's affecting sort of minority communities. What's your experience of the impact of the cost of living crisis?
I will draw directly from what Carleen has just said, and starting from the idea that poverty is not just about the individual student. We know that, for instance, in the UK, black people are 2.5 times poorer than white British people. So that means even without the cost of crisis, our students, black students, were already struggling. And then when you add this layer of limited funds nationally, you get a really tight situation for these students. So poverty becomes much larger. It's not just about housing, it's not just about transport. So all the other inequalities in society, for instance, racism being such a huge issue for black students, become more magnified. That when they have language challenges, that becomes magnified. When they have transport and childcare, like you've already mentioned, or even adult care, maybe looking after older family members, all of those things become magnified. And it creates something that in race literacy we call weathering, where the body of black people have suffered so much racism, merged with poverty, that physiologically and psychologically, black people suffer significantly. And this can then show in ill health. So they have greater health inequality than their fellow white students. And then black students are also, because of that poverty thing, which is obviously very linked to the cost of living crisis, they then need to work longer hours. But yet, racism means that they get lower paid work. So, adding longer hours with lower pay is just this recipe, a perfect storm for black students. And that's just starting a starter. Think about then issues like lack of trust in management. So, when these students have needs and they're feeling overwhelmed. They can't even trust that if they went to someone who's maybe in charge of their department or in charge of their workplace, that they will get the help that they seek. They can't even trust in that. So it's bearing the troubles, all their pains by themselves, for themselves. And yet, going back to what Carlene is saying, they often, Black people, Black students, will not be about themselves. They will have this collective responsibility where they're caring for people beyond sometimes the shores of the UK. And so when we think about Black students, think about a map of a number of people that they may be supporting, even though they are students. They themselves need help, but yet they have all these people dependent on them. And you can just picture the amount, the weight that these Black students are carrying, and then you expect them to excel at university, at work. Now, that's just starting. That's a good picture I think I've painted for how the experiences can become so magnified. This, we like to say, cost of crisis, cost of living crisis. It's much more than that for Black students.
Excellent. Thank you. Thanks for that, Cynthia. That was a brilliant kind of extension, to what I was trying to explain. I think the other thing I wanted to also to add is when you've got students on professional courses, universities require students to have financial means to buy the equipment they need. And I can imagine for nursing and for medicine and even in social work, students are required to still have access to some form of means. So for social work students, they have to have access to a car. So you need to be able to buy a car and then keep it insured, pay for driving license. I suppose other students on professional courses too are going to be expected to have access to vehicles to go and do those kind of placement visits as such. But that is like an added challenge if you don't have the financial means in any case. Some professional courses, there's particular uniform that has to be worn. Social work students, they are expected to wear smart formal clothing and ethnic minority students, they do take a lot of pride in how they dress for the occasion. And so sometimes it can feel really tricky, and I think it's important firstly for us to acknowledge that normally, because of the adversity ethnic minority students tend to face, they become very resilient because they have overcome barriers before. But it's important to acknowledge that, that even though there is resilience, there is still adversity where they have to deal on a day-to-day basis, and for people to understand how they can come alongside our students to ensure that when they're in professional courses, for example, consideration is given to the fact that actually it may be a challenge to buy a laptop to do, your coursework because the priority isn't necessarily that. The priority might be you have to pay rent to a landlord, for example, so I think universities have to be mindful of, these kind of challenges, because access to laptops, cars, electricity, keeping warm, those have now become secondary issues sometimes because, the priority would be to have money for food or warm, or a house to keep, to have shelter as such.
Thank you very much, Carlene, and sort of Rick, for bringing us back to almost that kind of, hierarchy of needs and how we can't make assumptions about where, people might be placing those priorities. Cynthia, you started to touch on things about power imbalances and also around about confidence in things in things changing. And that is a particularly complex thing to maybe try and tackle. But I did wonder if you, again, from either from your research, from the conversations you're having with people, as to where you kind of think that we can maybe start to redress some of these challenges.
When it comes to power imbalance and how management and those who are supporting or working with Black students can help to redress the imbalance, one of the things I think about is honesty. And it's honesty is a concept that's a bit troubling because you can't measure it. And in the West, we like to measure everything. And you're thinking, how do you bottle honesty and, know that someone's being honest? But I'll tell you something. When you work with an open heart with a black person, they know. You don't need sometimes to shout and jump. When you talk to black students, for instance, you will hear them say, "This person you can trust, this person," and they will tell their colleagues, "If you need help," and I mean other black students, their peers, "If you need help, this is the person you go to." What is that person doing? What that person is doing is being open and honest with the black students. So the black students know they can go to that person. And how do you become that person? You become that person by understanding there is a difference in experience and acknowledging that there is a difference. Understanding and believing that there are people who are genuinely marginalized. If you don't believe that, you won't even be a person that anybody could trust, the black students can trust. So, first of all, understand and believe that there is adversity, that racism hasn't gone away. It is so deep and it's still endemic, and black students know it. So, when you recognize that, and then you go, it's now on the onus is on the people who work with black students to raise the topic. And that's starting, "I see you, I hear you. What do you need?" And when you say that, mean it. And so you're saying to them, "I don't want you to tell me, oh, it's fine. I want you to really think about it and tell me, where are your challenges?" If you don't know where to start, just tell them, "Do you have enough food? Are you?" Questions, just ask it, and ask it in a way that you give the person the license to trust you. And in building trust, if professionals and managers, lower managers, don't know how to do that, they need to go back and learn how do you build trust with your employees, with your students, people who work under you. So, first of all, you go ask, what is going on with you? What are your responsibilities? What are your needs? And it's also good to say, "We can't meet this one, we can't meet this one, but I think we might find a way." So when you give room to the students to speak, be honest again, back again to honesty, and say, "We can't help with this, but you see this, I think we might have a solution somewhere." So my key thing is talking to the black students, saying, "We hear you, we know you will have a rougher time of this cost of living crisis." The minute you say that, I bet you any manager who says that to a student, the first thing they'll see is cry. Tears will run down the student's eye because they, first of all, want to be heard and seen. And I'm not just saying that, I'm saying that because I have seen that in practice. The minute you ask that question, you will see how emotional the students become. That tells you something. They needed someone to ask that question. That's just a starting point. Don't just assume that because they're so resilient, da, da, da. If you understand what weathering is, which is a concept that was developed in the United States, that shows that, for instance, we saw it during the COVID-19 pandemic, that black people died, and I mean died, at much higher rates than white people. And that was because biologically, physiologically, their bodies were being damaged by racism, by the clear, well-defined health inequalities that are linked to racism and poverty. So we know that. And so acknowledging that, understanding what weathering is, how this adversity affects black people, not to think, oh, they're resilient, they can cope. No, the resilience is there, but the carrying of all that adversity has actually weathered them. So whilst they may be resilient, they are still suffering inordinately.
Thank you very much for that insight, Cynthia, and also giving, sort of listeners sort of time to maybe reflect on again how they approach students, and with that kind of honest and open and the sense that they will be truly listened to, and because their experiences are different. And I know you touched on a concept which is around about confidence and people's ability to ask these questions and not feel that they need to shy away from them. So I think that that's a valuable point as well. But Carleen, as we move into sort of thinking about what how can we again either redress any imbalances, or what do we try to do to enable sort of things to kind of progress in a much more positive fashion than they maybe are at the moment. What ideas do you have that our listeners can maybe consider in terms of how what support structures they put in, how they interact with students? Over to you.
Thank you. I suppose, I mean, there's several things we could, draw out. But I think one of the key things I wanted to sort of highlight, Andrea, is the reality that when you an ethnic minority in a predominantly white space, it's incredibly difficult because you innately you are aware that you are having minority status. You almost more or less have to psychologically prepare for any kind of racism you may experience, perhaps not verbal racism, but definitely microaggressions, because these things are a reality. And these are the things our students themselves would experience. And drawing from research, but also our own personal experiences, is the reality that sometimes these racist attacks can be unprovoked and unexpected. So it's about being conscious that when you have an ethnic minority student on your course, there is this inner kind of concern that at some stage they may experience racism, which therefore, brings me on to the point that universities and placements have to ensure that there's greater racial representation in their workforce. Firstly, recruiting Black and ethnic minority staff is essential on the sort of courses and in the kind of sectors we're talking about, in the health sector, so that there's greater representation of the diverse needs, the patients and other people are going to experience. I think the other reason why it's so important to have greater racial representation, in the workplace and on, at university, is so that we can establish a greater sense of belonging. Because sometimes you feel you don't belong because people don't look like you, they think differently to you. You're isolated sometimes like that. So, by having greater racial representation, that fosters the sense of belonging. It goes for the lectures too. The content you're teaching has to have some form of relevance, where you draw on literature, material, practice models from, that's Afrocentric, that students can understand, that talks about the embodiment of that collective, responsibility and the connection, because students need to see somehow they belong in that space. But it becomes incredibly difficult when you occupy predominantly white spaces, and God forbid when you're competing for those kind of select few positions, that even become a lot harder. So I think universities and work placements have to sort of bear in mind that, somehow racial representation is key, because it can help you to get students to have that sense of belonging, but also make sure that your whatever you're doing is more culturally appropriate. And more than ever in the UK, we need that kind of diverse reflection of, of our communities to counter racialized, social work services and health services. So that is my suggestion. That's one way forward where we could maybe try to redress past imbalances or imbalances.
Thank you very much, Carleen. And that does remind us that, even though whilst we're exploring cost of living, that it's a much, there's so many other factors that feed into that. And you see that sense of belonging, is can be an enabler in terms of retaining a student as well.
Exactly.
Cynthia, again, is in terms of how do we move on? How do we sort of tackle some of the challenges that there are? And because it's the cost of living is being experienced differently by sort of those students from minority backgrounds. What's your insight as to how we can maybe move on and support this within the university sector?
I have one kind of anecdote that draws on from retention. A student just finished, about to finish, was working in the hospital, and one of the patients goes into cardiac arrest. This student has significant back damage from an accident, from a car accident, and she jumps on the back on this woman and pumps away for more than half an hour, doing more damage to her back, and brings this woman who was literally dead back to life. When the woman came back to life, that student wasn't actually working in that wing. She had just gone in there to do something else. Everybody was really praising her and everything. And then she started working in that wing. The person whom she helped to bring back to life said she didn't want the student to work with her because the student was black. Now, the rest of the team went and said, "Oh, you know that this is the person who brought you back to life. Nobody was here. You might have been dead by now. In fact, you would have been dead." And the woman still said, "Nope, she's black. I don't want to work. I don't need her help. I don't want to work." And I'll tell you something, that student is no longer a nurse today. What managers can do in instances like that is not just to insist that student goes back to work with this person. The student needs to be recognized and award that kind of thing. Say, this person helped bring this person back to life for whatever they did. Make a big deal of it. Recognize it because the harm that that patient has caused the student is significant. It's made the student leave the profession because it's that bringing in the trauma of bringing someone back to life when you shouldn't have been in the room in the first place, and then being kicked in the teeth and saying, "You're not good enough. You're not human. You're subhuman. So I don't want you to support me." And yet, this subhuman just brought you back to life. So that kind of trauma, the department where she was working in that hospital should have made a big deal of it, created an award, and recognized the student. Maybe she would have remained. So that's just one of the things where, when you see instances of racism, don't just say, "We've spoken to the person with." It's important to go and make something out of it, so that this student knows we've got your back. The students know we see you, we hear you, we know you, and we know you are worth your profession. You are in the right place. You're supposed to be here. So, one of the terms that's used in black circles is when you go into these spaces, back to what Carlene was saying, where you will find fewer ethnic minority lecturers in universities, especially in certain departments. Make a positive action task to bring them in. And the black literacy circles will say, when we get to these rooms, they don't allow black people at the table. And they're saying, "Go and get the table for the black person. Bring a table there." Yeah. And so, just one of those things I wanted to talk about retention, but going back to other ways that we can actually address these imbalances, I would say there are local supports. Lower managers and people who are supervising black students should think much more lower. What's going on? How can we support the students? So, because it's literally about poverty in this instance, what local supports are available? We did some work at UEA for a couple of our students who we just asked, and the students broke down in tears. They didn't even have food. So I'm talking about food to eat to get into work to do their placements. And what did we do? We didn't go through the formal processes of food banks. There are ways that, even as professionals, you can navigate this. So it's important for lower managers to start to think, what is locally available that we can support our students with? Look in your institutions, in universities, in the hospitals, wherever these organizations are there local grants? Are there small, tiny grants that can help black students? And it should be targeted. It's a positive action plan. So have a positive action plan for the black students in your team, in your departments, and then see what local supports that. And then I'll say something else. Because these students are working long hours, lower paid work, and all of that, think about direct tutorial support. We're also doing it at UEA now, where we're thinking about our black students and saying, we know that with racism and poverty, what you get is that they're also suffering academically. And so think about direct academic tutorial support. Organize within the small teams for those students. It's not, it's just learning, basically extra learning, but how do you organize it smaller within the teams? And I will say also, lobby the institutions. So the institutions need to hear it. It's not something that the lowest management person is just doing on their own. And the institutions need to hear it, and they need to think about this in a larger way. And it's not just about putting out something on their website and saying, oh, we support Black students, you know, we welcome you. No, we support you through these ways. We will provide material, tangible, concrete support for you through food, clothing, some care support. You can maybe bring your child into work on certain day. Is there a creche? Whatever. We will support you in this way. We will provide you extra academic direct tutorial support as well. So just a few of those. And I was just going to say projects. So academic projects that might generate money and provide money for the students. So whether it's within the institutions, universities and colleges, or even in the hospitals and other organizations where Black students work. I'll leave it there now.
Thank you very much, Cynthia. There's been so much rich conversation here in terms of providing insight to sort of, you know, how say the cost of living crisis is being experienced by students from minority backgrounds, but also in terms of the wider picture, and also challenging us with, you know, who are sitting in leadership positions within academia to think about, you know, what can we do which would be really concrete and make a difference. And you say there's some structural things around about representation, but there's also some really practical solutions that we can think about as well. And I think it's important to bring that out. So I'm really delighted that you've been able to join us today and give us those insights, and also to hear about your research. And I think, you know, our readers, sorry, our listeners even, will be very sort of curious to find out more. And so, I mean, please do share those findings with Council of Deans, and so that we can get those disseminated. On the topic of research, then, the EDI Strategic Policy Group is just about to launch a cost of living survey, which will go out to the universities as such, and it is going to be for something for staff to complete rather than necessarily students. But what we're keen to do is get some quantitative and qualitative data around about how what the impact of the cost of living crisis is, and to uncover whether that is really being sort of experienced unequally, or to get the hard facts about that as well, so that we can use that to again just bring a much greater lens upon this, and look at how we can leverage greater support in both the institutional level, but also, you know, sort of in terms of how we may be able to influence policy and the politicians as well. So this podcast has come to you as part of Race Equity Month. There are a whole series of activities and webinars taking place across November as part of Race Equity Month. So I would encourage colleagues to be able to tune in, to listen to what's you know, what's out there, and to take on board some of these very important messages, and to see, actively listen and think about what you can maybe do in your own organisation to take forward some of the real issues that will be brought to the fore. So thank you very much for listening,